Welcome to FemWonk, a podcast about politics, public policy, and current affairs that takes an intersectional approach to topics that we care about. I'm your host, Katie Davey. Thanks so much for joining me. Okay, so interesting topic today, and we're taking a little bit of a different approach. So I'm joined by, I don't know, an old friend. Is that what I would call you, Ben?
An old comrade, colleague.
Yeah, I'm excited about kind of the approach we're taking here. So one of my goals, I guess, for 2020 was to have more meaningful conversations. And over the past, I would say, I don't know, 5 or so years, there have been few people that I've had more meaningful conversations on broad topics than with you, Ben. So I think this will be kind of an interesting way to have a conversation. With that in mind, we're going to talk about the Democratic primary and specifically the Iowa caucus. Neither of us are experts in this area. We're more just kind of interested observers. So that's the approach we'll be taking. So let's just get into it. So we haven't on the podcast talked about the Democratic primary since probably like July, I would say. So a lot has happened. I'd first actually just love to get your overall thoughts on the race. Like what are you looking for? Or I guess, what have your overall impressions been from that outside perspective?
I think to date, I would say it's just started. Everyone knows these things are long. Candidates had announced their intentions to run as early as this time last year. But it's all just talk. It's all just speculation. I mean, Iowa isn't a big state, but I think it's when things just start to get going. So candidates have come and gone before we've even seen votes. So I kind of indicate this as the green light. This is where it really starts. It's been interesting to watch not so much the front runner candidates, so not the Bidens and Bernies and Warrens, how they perform, because it's anticipated that they'll kind of make it through the majority of the race. But I've been keen to watch people like Mayor Pete really surge, how people like Klobuchar and Yang have kind of beat the odds and made it this far. And then someone like Beto O'Rourke, who announced first and there was a lot of high hopes for and had a lot of Obama comparisons, dropped out so early. So I've been kind of watching those middle pack candidates and to see how they've played in the last 12 to 18 months per se. But coming back to my original point, I think it's just starting. So this is the stuff that we can actually watch and make some fact-based predictions on and some historical comparisons to see how things progress moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting thing to consider, right? That we're just starting, even though, like you said, folks have announced as long as a year ago and in some cases longer, right? Like I think probably Bernie Sanders probably said, last time right away that he was going again. It's not necessarily something we're used to in Canada, that kind of really 4-year cycle just going and going and going. I think it's, now that we have a fixed election date, it's something that is starting to creep in. But I think it's super interesting because I would say, again, I'm, an observer, but I'm already getting election fatigue from the US presidential, and it's, November 7th is quite a ways away already, or not already, still rather. I think the middle of the pack candidates is also an interesting frame because I think what we've seen there is some ideas that got a lot of attention that maybe wouldn't have from the kind of mainstream candidates. Even I think back to like Governor Jay Inslee coming on the stage and just talking about climate change over and over and over again. I think those voices were really important early on and kind of put some issues a bit higher on the map. And I think hopefully we'll see those topics kind of transcend over the next few, months still. And kind of what the more mainstream candidates continue to talk about.
Yeah, and I just think, we watch those middle of the pack candidates, and as from this point forward, I think it's also important to look at, okay, what do the tickets look like? You know, so we can identify who the winners might be out of a group of maybe four or five. But I think it's also from this point forward to start looking at, okay, what are the combinations of president VPs look like, and how does that play into the general? So those are some conversations I've started to have is with other people is, okay, what's the 1-2 spot look like? And how does that kind of appeal to the general public?
Yeah, and I think that conversation is dramatically different depending on who is in the number one spot.
Yeah.
Which, again, is, you know, maybe we're too early to speculate, but that I think is super important. And, you know, I don't love to get into the conversation around electability because I think it's a bit of BS. I think it's, you know, a way of entrenching, you know, a patriarchal society that we live in into mainstream dialogue. But I do think that the 1-2 spot or the 2 spot, depending on the 1 spot, is really important to electability. Let's just talk a little bit about the Iowa caucus, and then we can dig in, I think, deeper to some of these initial thoughts. So overall, like you said right at the beginning, Iowa is not necessarily a big state. So why is it so important in this overall conversation? So the main reason is because it is first. So in the U.S., unlike Canada, well, first of all, we don't have a presidential system in Canada, which, you know, I'm sure you agree shocks some people to know that they're not voting for Justin Trudeau or Andrew Scheer or whomever. I got so much of that during the last federal campaign. But in the U.S., so people actually do vote for who the president will be and, you know, in this case, who the candidate will be. Again, the comparison is a bit different. So in the U.S., every single state essentially has its own method of voting for the who they think will be the best candidate, and then they have different mechanisms and all that fun stuff. Iowa is a bit different because it is one of the only states left that has a caucus model, which basically means that on caucus day, the only way you can actually vote is if you show up to one of the locations. And then the other thing that I think is wild about the Iowa caucus is it's not a secret ballot. So essentially what happens is, like, you'll go and stand in a corner with all of your fellow Bernie supporters, and you'll stand in a corner or another corner with all of your fellow Warren supporters, which is kind of crazy for us to think about. But what happens is first, all candidates in that precinct, that location, have to get at least 15% to even be a contender for delegates. And then they do kind of a realignment, which again is essentially like a second ballot for any candidate that did not hit 15%. They get to essentially pick a candidate that did. So kind of wild. I think the best comparison we have to Canada would be like a leadership race. It's a kind of similar-ish model, but again, yep. We have nothing in Canada that is not a secret ballot. So that's super interesting. And it'll be interesting, I think, to see if there are any amendments to this model in Iowa after what we've seen, which is chaos on caucus night. And we're recording this at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, and there are only 71% of results reporting right now. So that is Iowa caucus 101. Did I miss anything critical, Ben?
No, I think that nails it. I mean, one interesting thing to remember or to note is that it was a little different this time where they did the 1-2. They kind of changed some rules around that. Everyone thought the way and the amount of numbers they had to report and keep track of this year would cause a mess. I don't want to get into the weeds of the mess itself and the time delay. We will know soon what the numbers were. In terms of winners and losers, one thing I have kind of noted going into it was the turnout, and that's the number I'm really waiting to see is how many people actually turned out on Monday night, because I think based on the the last two cycles, like the 2008 and the 2016. I'm curious to see those comparisons.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, you saw a lot of kind of punditry, there we go, leading up to the day about if it will kind of break some of the recent records for turnout. On the one hand, you would think it would because there's so many candidates, but yeah, I think that's an interesting piece to wait and see. The other thing that, you know, again, super basic outsider, the primaries happen together, right? So Iowa also happened for the Republicans on the same night. but yeah, nobody's talking about that today.
Yeah, I don't think there was much of a, you know, a headline news story there. There wasn't really a whole lot of surprise with the results of that one.
No.
But anyways. That's...
But it also brings up, though, a good or an interesting comparison where, again, here in Canada, we do partisan things at parties. Well, that sounded funny. We probably do them at parties as well, but parties are responsible for partisan things. There we go. That's a better way of framing it. Whereas actually, again, in this U.S. context, these processes are actually run by, you know, kind of what would be the equivalent of Elections Canada. So that's a super interesting thing as well to consider overall. And again, it's interesting that they're happening again at the same time. It's not something that happens behind party closed doors per se, which, yeah, I mean, I think is probably a good thing.
It's a very large and complex machine. So it can be very daunting, but it was designed that way on purpose. So it's a neat thing to look at and watch.
Totally. Okay, so let's get into our results as we have them. So again, at this point, 71% of the results are in. And from that number, we have Pete Buttigieg with 26.8%. We have Bernie Sanders with 25.2%. And in that case, both of them at the moment have 11 delegates apiece. Elizabeth Warren with 18.4% and 5 delegates. Biden with 15.4% and no delegates. And then Amy Klobuchar, 12.6% and no delegates. Nobody else really got anything worth mentioning. Yang got, I guess, 1% of the vote, which I don't know. I think it's probably an underperformance, but that's also because I'm a bit Yang gang. but yeah, okay. So from there, you know, we have five clear top of the pack, which, like you kind of mentioned, with so many candidates coming and going over the last year and a bit, it's interesting to see who has kind of maintained that top spot. However, again, I don't know if it means anything. I guess, yeah, what are your thoughts? What do these results mean?
One thing that stuck with me was leading up to the numbers being released, like 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday. David Axelrod, former chief strategist under the Obama campaign, said that Iowa doesn't pick winners, but it definitely picks losers. That was before we saw any numbers, but if you look at these numbers, there's a clear loser, and that's Biden right off the top. Super strong candidate going into this, not only competitive at the Iowa level, but winning at the national level, and comes out with nothing in terms of delegates. Of course, they'll argue, you know, issues with the system, and they'll complain, and you know, they had a good number in terms of percentage, but at the end of the day, you know, if Mayor Pete was to go in and be reversed with Biden in terms of numbers, the general comments from spokespeople said that his campaign would be over. So that's the first thing I noted, was that. The second thing was turnout, which we kind of talked about. It was anticipated that this one would probably fall right in the middle of 2008, 2016. 2008, we saw about 240,000 people come out. 60% of them were first timers. So obviously that's a huge drive from the Obama campaign, trying to get out, you know, those minorities and that African-American vote out to support Obama. 2016 dropped way off to 171,000. Right now, I think we're sitting at like 125, 130 based on the reports we have. So if we do some math, add the 30%, you know, we're in that 180 range. So those are kind of the big numbers that stuck out to me right off the bat. Was we've got a clear loser, and it looks like we're getting a bit more of a Democratic base fired up, which are bringing out some more voters, which is kind of a positive look forward on the general election, especially in a Midwestern state.
Yeah, I like how you framed that. There are clear losers, and I think that's so true. Biden being really the only one, right? Mm-hmm. I think everybody else not overperformed. I think Buttigieg, Klobuchar, and Warren all overperformed. Bernie, I think, was probably as good as he was going to. But yeah, like Biden really underperformed from my perspective. Yep. I think that being said, his team definitely, like I listened to a pod last week, maybe, Campaign HQ with David Plouffe. And he spoke with the campaign managers of Buttigieg, Sanders, Warren, and Biden. And even in that conversation, Biden's team was kind of talking about if they don't win Iowa, like basically Iowa and New Hampshire don't matter that much because they're going to pick up on places like South Carolina and other states. So they had already started positioning themselves with like, well, Iowa, but to come out of Iowa, like, doing this poorly, I really don't think was in the cards.
Yeah, and I think one thing that the Biden campaign has, you know, had in their corner leading into Iowa was how well they pulled with minorities, particularly African-American voters. And just, you know, the numbers are still rough, but kind of looking at some of the numbers, political broke down. Mayor Pete, Warren, and Bernie actually all did fairly well amongst larger populations of non-white voters, and Biden really didn't. So that should be a really concern going forward for them. And also to the point of that you made about their campaign chair saying, okay, we're looking at other states moving forward, is that once you get into those other states, the Biden campaign is going to be up against the Bloomberg money machine, who is seen as a kind of an alternative to Biden. So, you know, they've got an uphill battle ahead of them. This definitely wasn't the result they had anticipated. I think if anything, they want it to be, you know, top three, kind of a three-way tie. Everyone comes out with their fair share. That's not the case. And it's not, like I said, I think we picked a loser. And
yeah,
we've got not a clear winner, but a clear loser.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk a bit about Pete. You mentioned that you had been following along a little bit with his campaign over the last few months. Yeah, are you surprised at this turnout or the showing, rather? And what are your thoughts overall on how he has been surging, really, in the last few months?
I think I was initially surprised with the first place that he kind of came out on top. I was anticipating a top three. I was trying to kind of look at the numbers that we have released so far and to see, because overall, Bernie, in the numbers we have released, Bernie did better in first round votes. Pete didn't do so well. And Pete actually picked up more than anyone else going from first round to second round, whereas other candidates, you know, Biden actually lost some. Warren picked up a couple thousand. Bernie picked up maybe 1,000 or so. Yang lost quite a few. So I was just trying to look at those shifts to see, you know, if Pete's losing in the first round, where is he picking up in the second round? And what does that look like moving forward when other candidates start to drop out of the race? You know, so do the Yang supporters kind of favoring Team Pete? Is it the Klobuchards, the Steyers? Where are those votes coming from? Maybe it's some Bidens too. Pete is a candidate in the last, you know, 6 months or 8 months, whatever the rise has been, running a really impressive campaign. This is someone who came in with not a lot of or hardly any national recognition. you know, has probably had and will have some uphill battles with kind of the right wing America social views. But as a candidate, a young, ambitious, relatively well-seasoned politician, at least in the municipal level, military service, which will probably speak very well to some of the kind of more moderate central individuals on probably both the Republican and the Democratic side. So really, when you map it out, he's kind of the perfect candidate to kind of capture, I think, the base of the Democratic Party. I really believe he'll be able to pull some of that more left-leaning Bernie Warren support over to his side, because he's a real progressive and very well-smoking, very smart. I think he's a force to be reckoned with, and we're just kind of seeing the beginning of his strength moving forward.
So I'm out on Buttigieg. I think, although I don't necessarily disagree with some of what you said, I think his rise has been shocking. I think, it's fantastic that there's a candidate who is openly gay. I think he has run a good campaign. And even I remember, like, the way he entered the race, right? There was that whole kind of draft Pete movement. It wasn't like some of the other candidates. That being said, I just cannot stand, I can't stand how he has really tried to, like, I can't stand how inauthentic his framing of himself is. I think he often brings up the fact that he is a member of the LGBT community, which, again, is not insignificant, but, Bernie Sanders would be the first Jewish person to be president, for example. Elizabeth mm-hmm. Warren would be the first woman. So there are other, identity factors. There's also, I don't think it's appropriate, or, like, nor should we get into the habit of categorizing where, people's diversity factors rank. But I mean, he also draws on this narrative of, I'm not like the other one. Like, I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everyone else. And I'm kind of like, look, Pete, you are a white man. You are a Harvard grad. You're a Rhodes Scholar. You worked at McKinsey. And yeah, you did military service. But all of those factors, like, I'm sorry, but you can only say you're not like everybody else so much before all of these things kind of speak for themselves, right? That's what I have a huge problem with. I also have a huge problem with the fact, well, no, I don't, I'm not going to say I have a huge problem with it, but I mean, I think Pete also is a very moderate candidate, when you look at the slate.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I guess I don't, and as people have fallen out, he's not as moderate now, I guess. But still, like, at the moment, it's kind of like Biden, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, they're kind of all, in the Canadian space, they would all be right of center. And so, yeah, I think, like, I think what is happening is he has been able to capture this kind of odd moderate vote that still wants to kind of be progressive, which I think is realistically a huge part of the electorate broadly. I think, and he seems to be the natural alternative at the moment to Biden, but I think your point about Bloomberg is well placed, and I think, yeah, a lot of folks have been making that speculation. But yeah, so that is my word vomit on my real feelings about Pete Buttigieg.
Well, I just want to note this moment in time as a moment where you and I partially agreed on something political in a moment in time. So we both have some appreciation for Pete. Mine may be just like a little bit stronger than yours, but we're just going to write this down as an agreement on a candidate running at an election in the same election at the same moment in time. So
it's true. We don't have many of those.
No, those are few and far between, and this is probably the first. I do understand where you're coming from, but at the same time, I mean, Obama, Harvard grad, did a lot of more non-for-profit work, was a visible minority, didn't work for a huge firm. I think it's, you have to be as real as you want to be in these things. You also want to be strategic. I think there's a time when it's morally not okay to be strategic, and I don't think this is one of these times. Because at the end of the day, I think that if you put someone like Bernie up against candidate Trump, especially after watching that State of the Union, if you want to call it that, last night, it doesn't win. I think it's too far to one side.
I don't think Buttigieg does either, though. Like, I think he hasn't had, well, even if you look at the debate stage, anytime somebody seriously tries to not argue with him per se, but, you know, challenge his positions, he ends up looking and sounding a bit like a bratty kid who was told they can't have ice cream for dinner. Like, that, you know what I mean? Like, and I think that, but I totally agree with you about Sanders as well. I think Pete and Bernie are not, when we talk about electability, I think those two candidates lose against Trump. I think Warren and Biden have a stronger electability argument, but I think, yeah, for different reasons.
Yeah. I mean, like right now, I think my ideal candidate would be a Pete at the top of the ticket, and the jury's still out on whether I'd prefer a Bernie or a Warren on the VP. And I think I'm more inclined to a Bernie only because you have those candidates who follow Bernie who are, you know, Bernie or nothing. You don't necessarily have those with Warren. I think the Warren supporters understand the bigger picture, and that if she isn't on the ticket, they understand the importance of at least supporting the Democratic candidate, where the Bernie supporters aren't necessarily there. And with the Bernie supporters, you get the support of someone like AOC, who is a huge asset to any campaign, and I think could really rally behind someone who is young and new in politics like Pete. I think if you get a Pete Bernie 1-2, I think you really have a chance, because you kind of pull the whole both sides of the Democratic Party together, a really fired up hot base from the Bernie side, and someone like Pete who can appeal to the moderns, and maybe even reach across the aisle, because let's face it, in the States, military service is huge and it speaks volumes.
I think there's no way in hell Bernie Sanders would be Pete Buttigieg's VP.
I'm an optimist.
And the only reason I say that is because I actually very seriously, towards the beginning-ish of the race, so I say beginning-ish, starting around when the debate started, I really seriously thought that Warren didn't, because she didn't have a healthcare plan for quite a while, and I seriously thought it was, like, strategic and on purpose so that eventually essentially Bernie could leave the race, support Warren, and she could say, and I will be, like, my healthcare plan is Bernie's healthcare plan. Because he is a single issue candidate, right? Healthcare is his single issue. And so I actually think, like, you know, I and it's complicated because he's obviously higher in the polls right now, but I actually did think quite strongly that at some point he would bow out and support whichever candidate said that they would implement his plan. He still might, but that's not going to be Buttigieg. It's not going to be Joe Biden, right? No. So that's, I think, like, as things have started to shift a bit, that becomes quite a bit different.
And I worry that might be, and maybe it was when he ran against Clinton, but I worry if that is going to end up being, you know, the hill that he dies on, that Bernie, you know, He's choosing his battles. He's not looking at the war. And I think if he pushes this Medicare for all and the elimination of the private system entirely, that's going to hurt him in the long run. Understand and appreciate it from the side of you stick to your values and you fight for one thing. But that plan is no good if you never have the opportunity to implement even a part of it. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think too, like, the other big thing with Bernie that, like, is unfortunate is, like, he has kind of you talked about reach across the aisle with Pete. Bernie has no interest or track record in actually collaborating with people. And yep. I like people, not Republicans, people. and like that is problematic in the current landscape, I think. That being said, you know, like, it's not like Trump collaborates with people, and I think even Obama had a hard time doing it. But I think that kind of talks a bit to that that concessions argument that you kind of were just making. Like, he will ask for the kitchen sink, and he will not be happy with anything other than the kitchen sink. Whereas some of the other candidates, I think, would understand a more measured approach is more realistic. And to be fair, every candidate on the slate right now wants better healthcare. And I think many Americans want better healthcare as well. But yeah, to your point, like, you can't just wake up one morning and rip out an entire system and start over when for some people they think the system is working well for them.
No, I completely agree.
Okay. We've gotten into it, eh?
We've gotten into it. We're fired up.
I know. I'm like, where are we even at? I don't even remember. Okay. So I guess a question I have a little bit is what are your thoughts broadly on, like, the primary system overall? Like, it's so wacky, and with this many candidates, I think it is showing how wacky it really is. Because I think, like, yeah, when we go back to Iowa, there's no winner at all. Nobody even at this point cracked 30% of the, like, delegates, which is quite something.
No, I don't really have a for or against opinion of the whole primary machine itself. I want to say that it works, and it works well, and it's able to handle a lot of candidates in some sort of organized way. I mean, I think at one point we were, what, like 21 candidates. If we go back to, like, you know, 2015 era on the Republican side, they were in the, you know, 13 to 15 range of candidates too. Not that turned out well, but I can't imagine a system that could accommodate all of this many candidates as well as it does. You know, you compare it to our system right now, and you look at the conservative leadership race, which is just kind of getting going, but it's spread over what I think, you know, a few months right now. I know there's some urgencies with the reason for that, the minority government situation at the federal level, but, you know, they're looking for a candidate within 4 months. You couldn't get this kind of diversity of candidates in the American system if you crammed it all into 4 months and, you know, told everyone they're only allowed to spend $500,000 when you're trying to appeal to such a massive country, both in size, you know, population demographic, and just kind of political views. So as messy and as massive as it is and confusing, I can't think of an alternative that could really simplify it, aside from kind of the nitty gritty of rules from state to state that can be hard to follow.
Yeah, no, I think this is, like, a perfect example of us being kind of interested observers, because I think, like, you're right. I honestly I don't know enough about the system to even provide meaningful commentary. But I think one of the things that is interesting about this kind of state-by-state model, I mean, there's obviously Super Tuesday in March, I believe, where lots of mm-hmm. states go at the same time. But it actually allows candidates to kind of go state to state to state and actually engage a bit more meaningfully with voters, where that wouldn't happen if, for example, everybody voted on the same day. It would just be insane, right? Trying to reach, well, I guess it would be like election day, but not really, right? Like, so,
yeah.
But yeah, like trying to reach that many people, like, you know, 50 states over, like, if we even just think the fact that people have been going for a year and a half at this point, like, it just is not feasible. And I do think there's probably a more meaningful engagement with some voters, like, you know, I think Iowans. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think they've had the opportunity, you know, to meet every candidate 10 times by this point. But yeah, I think there's maybe like that meaningful engagement is probably a plus for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't like to include this in politics any more than I have to, but I think one thing that is the elephant in the room is money. And Super Tuesday is always a big indicator of the candidates who are in it to win it and really have the backing and those that aren't, because it is virtually impossible to cover that many states in a short period of time unless you really, really have the funding. And if you were to try and shorten this and kind of compress it into a smaller timeline, we wouldn't have candidates like Pete Buttigieg. We would not be talking about him today, because this is someone, I think he said it on stage once, I'm the only person on this stage who isn't a millionaire, right? So people like that wouldn't have the opportunity to fundraise at the same rate as someone like Mike Bloomberg, who has spent $200 million in the last quarter. I know that's two extreme examples, but you know, even the Warrens and the Bernies have some financial stability to kind of get right into things. And let the funding catch up to them, as opposed to slowly work their way in and build support and really establish themselves over a length of time. So I think you'd see a really different set of candidates. I don't want to use the word elite, but it would be kind of the front runners we have now would always be the people going forward. And that would kind of be the reality.
No, I think that's an interesting point. And you know, there's lots of criticisms, of course, of the money in the U.S. system, but there is an argument that it just does take money to, you know, to run a national campaign. I do think, like, I think there have been some really stellar candidates that have had to drop out because they couldn't raise the money. I think Cory Booker, for example, and I think that played a part in Kamala Harris's decision as well. Both two excellent candidates that would have been adding a lot of value continuously to the conversation. I think, like, honestly, Cory Booker was probably the most impressive candidate for me personally. But then you also look at, you know, I was just looking at fundraising numbers the other day, and to your point, yeah, like at the moment, Bloomberg is funding his entire campaign. He hasn't taken a single donation. And flip side, Bernie Sanders actually hasn't put a cent of his own money into his campaign. On the one hand, Bloomberg is kind of like, well, I have all this money, why would I take other people's money?
Right.
And then on the other hand, Bernie is like, I'm not putting a cent in because we should be able to run presidential campaigns fully grassroots funded, right? So yep. It's very interesting that you have both ends of that spectrum in the same party, first of all, but also still being able to kind of mount a presidential. I think Bloomberg, it's going to be so interesting to see how some of these upcoming states play with him in the actual game.
Yeah. And Bloomberg, I mean, I won't talk about him too much because he's kind of a forward-looking candidate, but it's just really interesting how he's come out and said, like, I'm willing to spend $1 billion regardless of who I'm supporting. I will support any candidate moving forward. Like, this isn't I want to be a president thing. That would be great. But he's not really in this with the sole intentions of winning. He's in this with the intention of removing the current president. So I think if you're going at it like that, you can't go at it and say, we're going to raise grassroots money to support other candidates. It's no, I'm going to spend a lot of my money because I have a lot of it to beat the president. And no one can really challenge that, I don't think, because the first candidate that comes out and speaks against that, he's going to be like, no, I'm going to give you money if you're the one on the ticket. So why are you saying no to me?
Yeah, well, and I think too, like, he's playing ball, right? Like, this Republican campaign will be likely the most well-financed campaign in the history of presidentials. It just will. And so he's playing on that field, right? He's not saying, okay, well, sure, I'm going to play on a dramatically uneven playing field so that we can just have four more years of what we've had. I think that's a reasonable part of the puzzle, right? The system is the way it is right now, and you can't change it if you lose the election.
Nope.
So let's talk a bit, like, just to conclude about moving forward. So New Hampshire is the next primary. It's up and coming, and that is a bit more of kind of what we're used to. So it's a secret ballot vote. I don't know what to qualify anybody as, but do you think anybody is going to drop out soon, I guess? I was soon. I don't know if before New Hampshire or soon after, but
I don't see anyone dropping out definitely before New Hampshire. I mean, I appreciate his optimism, but I'm kind of curious what Yang's going to do in the next. And I'm going to kind of talk like candidates from Steyer and up, because I honestly can't remember all the names of the other ones. So I think someone like Yang is probably going to look at New Hampshire. And if we see a similar performance in New Hampshire as we have in Iowa, I don't see a lot moving forward. I mean, they have some money that, you know, they've been okay with the fundraising. They did like $16 million in the last quarter or something like that, compared to like the 25-ish of the other candidates. That's someone I'd be curious to watch, because as I said earlier, I think a lot of that support goes right to Pete, because it didn't appear, based on the numbers we're seeing from the first and final round of voting, to go anywhere else, at least in substantial numbers. So that could be big for the Buttigieg campaign. I mean, some of it could go to Biden, and that could give him a little bit of push. Klobuchar, I'm not sure. I was, and I think as most people were, very surprised of her performance in Iowa. I'm not sure how I feel about her as a candidate. Hasn't really created the national recognition that someone like Yang and Pete have made for themselves, as long as she's been in the race and, you know, hitting every debate. Like, she just hasn't really come out with any big thing or moment or move to really solidify her.
Like, she's popular in the Midwest, but I don't think once we start getting, like, even in New Hampshire, I think her chances or her performance will go quite a bit down.
No. So I'll be curious. I mean, New Hampshire will be interesting because it has some, you know, it's different than Iowa, in the sense that it's, you know, an East Coast, so we would assume it to be a little bit more left-leaning in general terms than the Midwest. I'll be curious to see how someone like Buttigieg does in the dense populations, which he did fairly well in Iowa, and also did fairly well in the rural areas, which was a bit of a surprise. Probably New Hampshire, we're looking at more college-educated, definitely more white voters, so that's probably going to be in the Buttigieg corner. But at the same time, we're in Bernie and Warren territory. So
yeah, exactly.
I don't think Biden's going to really come ahead strong looking at New Hampshire.
No, South Carolina is where I think he'll get his boost again. I think I have very similar assessments to you. I'm super interested to what Yang is going to do overall, because, like you said, like, he has continued to meet every challenge he's been given, but nobody takes him seriously. Nobody on the stage, or, you know, on the stage, debate stage, nobody in the race takes him seriously, and the media really doesn't either, which is unfortunate, because, again, like, he has continued to build momentum, and I think his base is probably quite dominated by first-time voters and party members, so we'll see. But I think the other piece, like, it's interesting that you talked about, again, his voters perhaps going to Pete and Biden, because I would say those two candidates are probably furthest away from his core message of the universal basic income, right? Not that Bernie or Warren are interested in it at this moment either, but Yeah, so it'd be interesting overall, I think. And then we also, you know, we're going to keep having debates.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. It's and so I guess crazy.
the other candidate that even comes in below Yang is Steyer. And mm-hmm. although his numbers aren't great, the guy has spent some money. He, you know, was like $157 million or something in last quarter. He had about 2,300 votes in the first round of Iowa based on the numbers we've seen. That dropped way down to below 300. So, I mean, although it's only 2,000 votes and change, that's essentially pretty close to the difference between Pete and Bernie. So yeah. Those votes have to go somewhere. And if Steyer drops and puts his support behind someone, they've just captured the support of a billionaire who is willing to...
I can appreciate that. I think, though, that, like, we're talking a little bit, too, about the overall appeal across the country.
Yep.
And, you know, we talked a bit about Warren and Sanders in New Hampshire. And then, you know, I keep forgetting Tulsi is still in the race.
Yeah.
super weird, but she'll pick, she'll maybe pick up some in Hawaii. how many delegates does Hawaii have?
Don't know. Who knows?
And then, yeah, I just want to wrap up a little bit with the debates. And the only reason why is because in the summer when I did an episode about debates, I was like, yeah, we need, so this was before the federal election. And I was like, yeah, we need more debates because we need more opportunities for, the leaders to provide substantive commentary on issues. And I was all in on more debates. I still am at the federal level in Canada. I think what happened, like what we very visibly saw in this last federal election was because there were just really the one English, two French, mm-hmm. that the leaders just all they cared about were kind of gotcha moments. And that just doesn't provide for any sort of real value to citizens. However, now that we're on like what number 6 or 7 in the Democratic primary, sure. I'm like, okay. There is too many debates. There is a number, but we need to find it.
yeah.
I just know your thoughts on that. I know you've been following along with them as well a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the debates were interesting. We were doing, what, like 3 a week, I think, at one point, just to kind of make sure everyone was included, all 20-something candidates. So I think moving forward, the debates should be a little bit better, should be some more substance. I like to hope that there'll be more substance. As we move closer to the general election, people will really have to come out, and they're not so much selling themselves, but their platforms and their ideas. So that could differentiate some people moving forward. That could give us some distinction between Bernie supporters and Warren supporters and Pete's and Biden's. It'll be really interesting once we get someone like Bloomberg on the stage, provided he can qualify for debates. I know his funding model has eliminated him from some of the other ones. But, you know, what does someone like that look on the stage? It's someone we've never really seen in this kind of debate setting. He'll be new, but he is polling relatively well for someone who started late. So does he get on the debate stage and just completely mess the whole thing up? He doesn't have a history of federal politics or even state level politics, really. So, you know, his track record is kind of hard to compare next to someone like Bernie, who is a career politician at the federal level. So there's those people that we have to consider. But at the end of the day, I think the size is really what's going to make the difference. If we put 6 candidates on the stage, they're concrete, it's easy to follow, and hopefully we actually get some good dialogue going forward. But hey, who knows?
Who knows indeed?
Who knows?
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, leave us a review. You can keep up with us on social media by following @FemWonk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. See you next time.